Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for thrill hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Custer.
In this weekly segment, we break down stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for December 15th, 2025. All right, Tom, what do you got for us?
All right. An interesting one that's kind of hot and heavy right now, but we're going to kick it off with a article from Unit 42. It's titled Exploitation of Critical Vulnerability in React Server Components. So Unit 42 reports in this article on vulnerabilities that are affecting modern JavaScript web application stacks, React and Next.js, that can be chained into serious server-side impacts, including unauthorized actions and potential remote code execution. So this vulnerability in question, if you haven't heard about it yet, is CVE-2025-55182. It's also referenced as React to Shell. It is a critical unsafe deserialization flaw in the React server components flight protocol that allows unauthenticated attackers to execute arbitrary code on the server. So this flaw enables an attacker to send a single malicious HTTP request, which the vulnerable server then processes, leading to a complete system compromise without requiring any user interaction or authentication. These flaws are particularly dangerous because they affect a framework level behavior, not custom application logic, meaning the vulnerable patterns may be widely deployed across production environments. The vulnerability is present in versions 19.0.0, 19.1.0, 19.1.1, and 19.2.0 of the React Server DOM Webpack, the React Server DOM Parcel, and the React Server DOM Turbopack, as well as the frameworks that are bundling these packages. So that's that Next.js in the versions 15x, 16x, as well as Canary build starting from 14.3.0. Other ecosystems that are affected too, the React router, Waku, Redwood SDK, Parcel, and the Vite RFC plugin. All of these are affected as part of these vulnerable React packages. So from a threat actor perspective, these bugs enable that low noise exploitation against high value web infrastructure, especially APIs and application backends exposed to the internet. So some of the techs, the technical pieces from this, the vulnerability stems from that improper handling of that server side execution context. The exploitation does allow that unauthorized invocation of server logic, which bypasses intended access controls. It creates a pathway for privilege escalation inside the application layer, especially when server logic interacts with databases, authentication flows, or internal APIs. That's the React side. So the next.js side, it affects the next.js server actions and routing mechanisms where crafted requests can trigger unintended server-side behavior. Under certain configurations, attackers may execute arbitrary server actions, access internal endpoints, or chain into that RCE adjacent behavior, depending on what server actions are exposed. And that issue is amplified in the apps that assume that that framework level routing and action exposure is implicitly safe. So what does this all mean in the wild? So right now we are seeing, and it's being pretty decently reported in a handful of places, but there is a bull run, if you will, on exploitation in the wild for this, especially given that the vulnerability itself requires no user interaction or privileges, and the ability to exploit it is pretty much 100% reliable. So some of the stuff that we're seeing post-exploit activity, there's immediate activity leveraging, once the exploit happens, immediate activity that's leveraging wget and curl to pull down and execute additional payloads, which has been seen in one example deploying the XMRig malware. Attackers focused at major cloud infrastructure with similar curl and wget commands to pull down payloads. In some reported instances, the code block that they're showing that's being executed is pulling that payload down. It'll actually leverage curl, and if that fails, it'll fail over to wget. And then it immediately does a chmod command to set the payload for execution, and then will execute all in the same command block. There's also reported instances of attackers leveraging reverse shells from Cobalt Strike servers, interactive web shells being installed from GitHub that will immediately kill all existing Node.js processes with the intent to remove poor conflict, and then use Node to deliver additional payloads and establish more connection, more web shells. One that is stood out a little more, at least from my eyes, Scott, there's been reports of the DPRK delivering what's called EtherRat malware, leveraging similar techniques of that kind of curl wget payload pull down, the chmod to set to execute and then executing. But EtherRat deploys its own legit version of Node.js runtime and leverages Ethereum smart contracts for C2. So we're seeing that yet again. There is also been a newly discovered backdoor based on Unit 42's reports that's being delivered called K-Swap Door, which implements a sophisticated P2P mesh network, allowing multi-hop routing between infected nodes. And it uses AES 256 CFB encryption with that Diffie-Hellman key exchange for C2 comms. And it includes dormant passive packet sniffer code for like potential firewall bypass, as well as providing those full remote shell capabilities, command execution, and so on. So a lot going on with this. One of the things that I do find interesting with the React to shell, at least right now, not necessarily a standout, but it's being blasted by many people. So there's been a lot of different identification of post-exploit attack, but very little attribution. The one specifically to the DPRK has been kind of the biggest one that I've seen so far. Some of the things that I've noticed here that are items you can go after really from the hunting side, there's a couple things that are really obvious and stand out to me, Scott. One is that curl wget followed by execution, the curl wget sequence where they do a try one, fail to the next one, leveraging that curl of wget pull down to then run a chmod on the payload and then immediately execute it. Those are all, we shouldn't generally see that kind of activity in that sequence or at that speed. The other thing too is a lot of the exploits are taking aim at leveraging that node runtime to be able to leverage delivering payloads, establishing shells behind that runtime, you know, wall. So identifying things that are suspicious child processes of like Node.js as example, those are big standouts for post-exploit for this specific vulnerability in my eyes. And there's a handful of other things. So we've also seen some of the other low-hanging fruit that's associated with encoded PowerShell commands, leveraging PowerShell to pull down additional payloads, things of that nature that we've talked about before. But those first two really were kind of standouts to me because those are ones that are being reported pretty regularly across many different non-related attributed attacks. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on this whole one. This one's been a little noisy the last few days.
Yeah, I mean, what's most interesting about this is, you know, for those that aren't really familiar with what React is, it's basically a JavaScript library for building user interfaces. And that's kind of why the name React, because the idea is you can build these app components that are reusable. And it's a way that React will figure out how to efficiently update the page when data changes. So either user inputting data or data in general. So it's like the page can be dynamic based on the user interface. So it's kind of commonly used in a lot of places, and something that's traditionally changed is a lot of times when you think about when people interact with the web page, a lot of it's done on the user browser side. But for pages to render faster, they basically have moved a lot of the React functionality to the server side. So it reduces a lot of the client side JavaScript, which is great. But now you have components that are only on the server and newer architectures. And that's kind of where their vulnerability lives, because if we're able to take advantage of React, now you're actually impacting the server with remote code execution and things like that. So it's kind of like a very essential, I guess, library that a lot of people would use. So that's kind of why there's widespread stuff. Obviously, it seems very easy to take advantage of. But like what I love about this report is, like you mentioned, there's multiple people attacking this. and there's kind of like different flavors in the mix. And this is kind of why I almost don't care as much about attribution, because it just highlights that they all have to achieve the same thing. It's not like someone kind of use it differently. It's about, hey, if I take advantage of this, I can execute something. But if I want to do more, I either have to run something that will pull down my payloads and then figure out how to run those locally, so I have more access for things, or I'm just basically gathering information so I figure out ways where I can execute something and be able to see the return of that if I want to get like read certain files or system specific files and my help with getting credentials or whatever that is, right? And so all the different examples provided kind of encapsulate that. There's different ways for, do they chmod, do they not, do they pipe things directly to bash, do they call bash separately, all those types of things in some of those instances. And so I think it's really cool to see, because it really highlights why as security professionals we focus on that attack path or attack chain, or the MITRE verticals and things like that, because it does tell that narrative. And understanding what people have to do to get to the next step really helps you either figure out what areas maybe you're missing in an investigation and like potentially where to look, or understanding what the overall impact is. Because if you only can tell the story so far and there's no signs of anything else, you can say, yeah, they could figure out how to do this next part. But there's this great examples of things we've covered in the past. So it's not like anything is like net new from a post exploitation, especially if some from a public facing web component, right? And especially with remote code execution, that's kind of like, that's why we created hunts on the specific behaviors you called out, because it's just reliable, and that's kind of how people typically attack those things. So yeah, overall, I thought it was really interesting. I do think it's interesting with the bringing their own version of Node in, to then obviously they leverage their tool sets that they are comfortable with or want to have certain capabilities. So they're trying to create their own ecosystem based on taking advantage of this, which is much more of a fingerprint than you say some of the other activity that's being seen with this as well. But yeah, so I would say you kind of covered a lot of the key things. I just wanted to cover exactly, you know, what it is we're seeing, why this is so widespread, and kind of why we think about post-exploitation and threat hunting the way we do, because this is just a great example. Like I said, you see same behaviors, sometimes overlapping, sometimes slightly different. But, you know, then the question is, how do you build, if you want to look for this behavior overall, like generalize it, is it possible? Can you say, five different actors took advantage of this, they did something similar, how can I generalize that so that anyone taking advantage of this I see, and don't get so hyper-focused on who, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's a cool article.
Right, especially when vulnerabilities, you're mostly concerned, especially with things like this, when you see a 10, you want to protect your environment first, right? So just understanding how to protect it right away. Just referencing a couple other small things on this, there was another article. I leveraged this one because it kind of had a lot of things encompassed plus some additional, but there is an article that was actually posted around this a couple days prior to that from Sysdig that talked about a lot of this activity, identifying the Ethereum smart contracts being leveraged. But in that too, they also had pointed out some other common behaviors for post-exploitation that I didn't initially mention. So, you know, things like a lot of your discovery stuff. So your excessive, you know, Windows discovery commands, or, you know, kind of targeting that AWS simple storage discovery, that S3 discovery stuff. So there's things like that are occurring too, that are also common when it comes to post exploit. But inside of that too, what's interesting to your point, Scott, is we do see those kind of tried and true post exploit behaviors. But it's also interesting to see that there is a pivot to some of the stuff that's being leveraged more now. So like the Node, the leveraging of Node, right? That's kind of like becoming, I don't know if it's not necessarily novel, but it's seemingly being used by a lot more people, that technique, that behavior, or that behavior chain. Also, one of the things that I found interesting in this one too is Trufflehog reared its ugly head again. So we're seeing deployments of Trufflehog to look at secret scanning and stuff like that. So yeah, keep your ears to the ground on this one. Definitely patch if it's applicable for you. There are updated patches out there to close this gap. But yeah, it's a fun one, man.
What do you got next for us?
So next, you know, this one is just interesting because you normally don't see, I guess, this behavior that often, or doesn't get reported on that often, but it's from the Kawaii AI. It's a blog they have. It's called Inside Ghost Poster, How a PNG Icon Infected 50,000 Firefox Users. So this was interesting because essentially a ghost poster is a malicious malware campaign. And what it did was it hid malicious code inside the logo images of what seemed like benign browser extensions. And there is kind of a theme as far as like what browser extensions they kind of, I guess, targeted that people might pull down. And it was like dealing with like proxies or VPNs, type of extensions that we see, like FreeVPN is one of the ones they showed, Urban VPN proxy, stuff like that. Anything that's like ease of use stuff, dark reader, weather. So they kind of across the board, right? And what's interesting about when you install an extension, if you notice your extensions have kind of a logo attributed to them. So it's very common for your extension to then pull down the logo, right? Because it's going to utilize it. But in this case, they're using steganography. So, and steganography is the way to basically hide data in plain sight, essentially. It's not like necessarily encrypted. It doesn't have to be. And a lot of times you hide it in media files. In this case, it's image file because it's the logo itself. And so when the extension pulls that logo, then it looks for a key signature, which is in the data, basically three equal signs, which tells it where the embedded code begins. And it extracts that. And what's kind of cool about that is then it's able to build this JavaScript and then run it. And by doing that, now they have something that basically checks in, you know, not super frequently, but has the advantage to basically take over a lot of the browser. And so they do tracking injection, security header stripping. So any of the things that you might, you know, browser might try to block you from going to, captcha bypass type stuff. They do hidden iframe injection, which basically can, you know, enable ad fraud or click fraud or even more additional tracking there. But one of the other things I thought was interesting was, attribution? That's not affiliate code. So when you go to different websites, and maybe you see a product you want to buy and you click on a link and it takes you to where you go to buy it and things like that, there's something that tracks along the way, which is called an affiliate code. And it's basically giving credit to where you may have seen something advertised or where something was shared. So they get some revenue from that. Like, hey, if I'm basically a referral, it's like, you know, you refer a friend and you can get like $50 back or a discount on something. Same idea. And that's kind of how it seamlessly happens behind the scenes on the web or the internet, the interwebs, if it's not like an old person. This, what's cool about this and what I think is unique is one of the things they target is they basically hijack that affiliate link and insert their own to basically collect revenue from what would be normal affiliates that people commonly browse, which is an interesting way to make money. One, I think it's interesting because I don't hear a lot of people targeting that. But two, I also wonder how sustainable is that, because I imagine that would become pretty obvious pretty quick when someone's like, hey, our pay's drastically reduced, or if the affiliate, like the people are used to seeing who gets affiliated, there's one just bubbling up everywhere. That was something. The other thing that was interesting with the JavaScript that they encoded was they kind of did some, I would say, kind of in before they had Base64 encoding, they did some kind of further on encoding that was unique to them, where they basically, for the Base64 encoded script they were running to further the compromise, they swapped all lowercase and uppercase letters and swapped all 8s and 9s within the Base64. So I thought that was interesting, a way to where even if you came across the Base64, it would still look like Base64. And so then you would typically, when you're used to dealing with, you know, forensics artifacts like that, you might say, oh, this looks like Base64. Let's see what it is. And then it doesn't actually decode properly. Then you'd be like, oh, maybe it's something else. It kind of throws you off the scent a little bit. And it was just a simple swap. Obviously, if you, you know, analyze things further, you'd find the function to basically decode before the Base64 encoding, which would help identify that. So yeah, I just thought it was a really interesting campaign to kind of pay attention to. I want to say the other thing that was mentioned, that they had some hard-coded domains that they were using. So that was one way where it was easy to tie a lot of these extensions together. And so that's something else that you could pay attention to. And that's assuming that you can put the timeline together and your tools can see it. But if something, an extension is being installed, and then based on that installation, you can do some temporal analysis that there's a call out to a weird domain in conjunction with that, maybe it can be kind of an indicator. But I don't know what that looks like in practice to really make that operational, and or you know, what other kind of noise could exist based on just normal activity going on at the same time. But yeah, it's just a kind of a cool little attack. Some of the things they're targeting to take advantage of are a little nifty from a money earning potential. But yeah, I don't know many tools that are going to really look into this, you know, this way. Even tools that look for JavaScript, it would never see this from a security standpoint. So kind of crafty to kind of get past everything as well. So yeah, what were your thoughts when you saw this?
Yeah, man, browser extensions, they're fun. The money part was really interesting. So I thought that was crafty. You know, it's hard. It's like, I don't want to encourage it, obviously, but it's kind of like, that's the thumbs up in thinking, like, that's, it was creative anyway. But one of the parts that I thought too, because when I read stuff like this, my first, just because of my training and my like path through cybersecurity, I've always fell on that whole, I want to hunt, I want to detect side, right? So I always look at articles like, what can I find? Where could I find it? What would be avenues that might be custom ways in my environment I can go after something? And then I was like, okay, well, you know, there's not a lot to necessarily see here. But okay, maybe the communications, maybe the callbacks might be a thing. And then, you know, looking at where they were talking about how the loader was working, it would actually do check-ins every 48 hours.
Yeah, slow.
But it only actually would pull payload stuff down based on this report 10% of the time. And the other 90% of the time that they tracked in those check-ins, it just didn't do anything. And I thought that was really interesting because, man, that's like that low and slow, that crawl, like it would be really hard to detect something weird in that pattern. And then I wondered, just a more of a tongue in cheek question. I wonder how much of that is planned by design, or like the attacker gets to the place and says, okay, now I think we'll, you know, we have you. So now we'll send something. And then at the next interval to grab something, you know, but it's still very interesting because there's like, you know, this does a bunch of things and you really can't find it.
Yeah. And I would say, like, you know, this is a great thing where an attacker has achieved pretty much all they want to achieve, you know? So like, as far as other than potentially sharing some data, or if there's some sort like slight tweak, or they need to have the flexibility, so if something happens, they can adjust, but you know, they don't really need to do much communication, especially if they're making revenue off of the affiliate link stuff, because they don't even have to be involved anymore. Once that's in place, it's just kind of running on its own. I mean, it kind of makes me think of the Office Space thing where they put the virus to steal the penny, the fractions of a penny, right? That whole cost up, right?
Talk about the massive income, huh?
Right. And so there's that, that they have to be more worried about how is the money traceable back to them when they start actually trying to get to the money. But the other thing, you know, makes me think about is, sometimes some organizations really do care about their software inventory, right? And so they kind of have like approved applications versus, or maybe they govern all of it, or maybe a certain area they govern all of it, and others are a little more open. You know, more and more we're seeing where, because web browsers is like the program, right? I mean, honestly, if Linux and Windows didn't exist and there was just something that was a browser, a lot of people would still use their computers the same way, you know? So, I think we do have to start thinking about these extensions as the same way we would do acceptable applications. And not saying that we just like lock them all down, don't use them. It's understand what people are using extensions for and actively find the ones that you would approve as like a library of, oh, you want something that helps, you know, do this or do that. Use these things, right? From a company standpoint, because in here, I'm sure there are things that help steal information. Obviously, if you're using extensions personally, you're at some risk there. But from a company standpoint, organization, that's when you really should be concerned, because you know the affiliate money making scheme from a organization's environment is not as I guess doesn't produce as much revenue as if you were to actually take over and have access to an organization or company. So, man.
Yeah, pretty cool. It's a fun one.
Yeah. All right. So what you got for us now?
All right. I'm going to go back into the weeds. Sorry, man.
No, you're good.
Do the fun one today. My next article is from Checkpoint Research, so it's titled Inside Ink Dragon, Revealing the Relay Network and Inner Workings of a Stealthy Offensive Operation. So Checkpoint Research identified a sustained, sophisticated espionage campaign by the Ink Dragon Threat Cluster. It's linked by multiple vendors to PRC-aligned actors targeting government, telecom, public sector networks since at least 2023. A defining trait of this campaign is the creation of a victim-based relay network. This is one of the, I think, more interesting points of this whole thing, but we'll get to that. Compromised servers are turned into active nodes that forward commands and traffic, effectively forming a distributed mesh of relay infrastructure that hides the actor's operational origin and complicates detection. Ink Dragon's targeting has expanded geographically over time, with recent emphasis on government entities in Europe, in addition to Southeast Asia and South America, illustrating both persistence and strategic intent. The operation combines exploitation of web application misconfigurations with disciplined, low-noise lateral movement and a mature tooling ecosystem that blends malicious activity into normal enterprise telemetry. So there's a heavy focus on how they blend into normal noise. So the relay network is via ShadowPad. So the group deploys a custom ShadowPad IIS listener module on compromised IIS servers using the HTTP add URL API to dynamically bind those endpoints and turn victims into command traffic relays, effectively cloaking C2 infrastructure through a whole mesh of hacked servers. The initial access paths, Ink Dragon commonly exploits predictable ASP.NET machine key misconfigurations to perform view state deserialization attacks for remote code execution, and has also abused SharePoint tool shell vulnerabilities to gain initial footholds to on-premise SharePoint servers. After that initial compromise, the actor extracts IIS worker app pool credentials and the local secrets, often using them to pivot laterally via RDP proxying and authenticated SMB NTLM sessions, and then moving quietly through environments with those reused and shared service accounts. So Ink Dragon locates the, for as far as privilege-esque and kind of like a domain dominance, if you will, Ink Dragon locates idle RDP administrator sessions and then uses memory extraction techniques to reuse tokens and those NTLM verifiers, enabling that authenticated access for lateral SMB and domain escalation, really culminating in domain-wide control. Throughout these operations, they would also write to admin shares and then focus on targeting exfil of those ntds.bit and registry hives. So the group, from egress side, the group creates permissive firewall rules, trying to hide them into what would look normal, labeled to resemble legitimate processes like msmpeng.exe that allow any-to-any outbound traffic by bypassing those egress controls and enabling a broad exfiltration and enhancing those relay communications. So the tooling that was mentioned a little bit ago, there's been updates along with the use of ShadowPad, which I believe we talked about last week or the week before, Scott, but other tooling of note that was reported here. Yeah. Ink Dragon, they introduced a new variant of the final draft backdoor that has enhanced stealth, high throughput, exfil, cloud-aware communication channels, and timing controls to help them blend their check-ins and their callbacks with normal business activity. They also leveraged other tools, one specifically called LALS Dumper, which registers a malicious SSP DLL in LSAS and extracts a compressed LSAS memory dump with custom direct syscall logic. So some pretty cool stuff there. Really, the biggest takeaway I had around this one, man, it was just the absolute effort to blend in. I think every single point in this was specifically with the purpose of blending into normal activity. I find that the custom web or the custom the building of a mesh network, so in having the proxying and relaying go through that was very interesting to me. I did pull out a couple bullet points to kind of that for me the takeaways to kind of look for, hunt for type things. Identifying some of those listener anomalies. So, unexpected HTTP listeners or bindings created with that HTTP add URL API, particularly with wildcard patterns or from endpoints that just don't align with stuff that you're used to. The use of the tool shell exploit, that one stood out to me because there's a handful of things out there that you can look for that. One of the low hanging fruits for that one is looking for those suspicious child processes of that IIS worker process, so that W3WP.exe. Also identifying the direct exploit of that. So usually, or from that vulnerability, what you're going to be looking for is specifically crafted HTTP posts to those layouts. /toolpane.aspx or that layouts /signout.aspx that's specifically relevant directly to that vulnerability and exploit. Really, I just found this one fascinating, Scott, because of that thing that I said about the blending in. It was very interesting to me, the use of a mesh network like that. I could see how that could help hide your traffic even further than just, modifying your, trying to give out random callbacks or check-ins to your C2. There's a lot here that is very sophisticated in my mind. I'm curious what you thought.
I mean, what I like about this is the scale of everything, because everything that really is discussed doesn't really go into so much of impact as far as what things other than gaining tons of access and more persistence and building out this network essentially was really the key pieces, which kind of highlights what's the purpose of this campaign, attack, whatever you want to call it. It lends itself to kind of that typical nation state activity, right? Get just enough, learn what you can. Now you also have, we're commonly seeing where for a while there you would see a lot of attackers kind of using cloud infrastructure because it's really hard to block and, whatever. But as people get smarter with dealing with those problems, it's much harder if another company is compromised and they're able to, proxy things through legitimate companies that you wouldn't understand why they're talking to you, but that it's from every point of data you can collect, other than looking at the raw data that may be being transmitted, everything looks legitimate. It's hard to explain. And especially from a security practitioner and not someone who works or runs the business, you might not understand why you're even talking to the business per se. That part's really interesting, but I still love the level of effort they go through to hide. And so it kind of, brings me back to kind of what we talked about previously. That first initial step, looking for the suspicious child processes of W3WP, is a key piece, because then you're there's something going on there. Now, granted, they talked about how they have different tools and the things they're targeting where they're trying to get possibly the .dit database from a DC to get the hashes. They try to see if there's any idle RDP sessions that may be established so they can take advantage of it, getting things that way. potentially extracting NTLM hashes, doing a lot of scheduled task stuff as well. And then you have the typical lateral movement. So, you know, if you see authentication on maybe some server, and then you start seeing the same authentication almost in a timeline approach to adjacent servers or similar servers or, you know, whatever, you know, those types of patterns can kind of stand out. But they're harder. You can see how once they gain access and just get the right set of credentials, how much harder it is to identify someone who has no intention of like serious impact. Because once they have the right keys, as long as they're not being incredibly loud, they kind of do just blend in. And especially if they have, if there's no rush and they can take their time. So this just comes back to, what does initial access really look like? Do you look for those types of things, right? And I feel like anyone that runs web public web servers needs to understand and have that process execution to know when things are outside the norm there. But then there's traditional things like, what does internal discovery look like? What are those common attacks that try to extract credentials, either by touching certain registry hives, the ways people can copy things out, even though they use a lot of custom malware to kind of hide their overall persistence and activity. One, they're still kicking off things with that malware or hooks that may not be your typical parent-child relationships that hopefully you maybe can identify and compare across your infrastructure. But they still have to leverage some kind of lulled-in traditional attack pass before they get everything in place. So that might be a small window that you have to have the right visibility into. And I think that's why threat hunting is also nice, because, you know, threat hunting is kind of a retrospective look in a way, right? Because you have to have enough data generated and then say, okay, we have these ideas. Now let's see if we see these present themselves in a certain way or an interesting way in our environment over the past month, over the past week, depending on what it is and how it is you're looking for it. So yeah, really, really cool, a breakout of kind of a sophisticated attack. And to be completely honest, like other than like the traditional like banking Trojans is still banking data when I was growing up in security, these were the attacks, the kind of attacks we all just heard about, and having no experience, you were kind of terrified. Like, I don't know how to detect this. You know, that was like your first thing. And it's really just focus on the easy wins, right? And then once you master those, sometimes all you need is an easy win, and everything else you can, you know, follow the chain of things. But then you mature from there, right? So yeah, kind of a cool overall write up, and also shows the, you know, there's a lot of things that haven't been fixed from previous vulnerabilities that are still being leveraged.
And that was one of the first takeaways. Well, and that's, you know, every environment has their X, Y, and Z reasons. Like, we know that, right? Like, we fought battles relative to things like that. But just thinking about like, I think this thing was, I think Tool Shell was a 10, at least it was a high 9, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And that was like June, July, I believe. Like, that was.
But I also believe that if you didn't resolve that correctly, like you didn't roll the keys, there's a way to roll the keys, then you think the problem's fixed and it's not. So that just comes to like fully understanding the problem. And it's great if you have someone that you can kind of help test if that's still a problem to validate, you know, your patching and things. But yeah.
Yeah, and any, you know, to your point, like early on, like the things we were like day one when we had dropped into a place that it was all brand new and we're trying to figure out what to do. And we're like, yeah, we read about this stuff. Not to the depth back then either. Like the intel didn't have the depth that it has now, where you got to actually see some of the breakdown, some of the actual activity was just generally talked about. They did these things, right? But you never knew how. So you're like, how did we track these guys? But any young hunters out there, any young security practitioners, if you spend some extra time reading intel, look at what nation states are doing. They tend to, I think we've talked about this. I think I specifically brought this up. They tend to not hit the top headlines always. And that's, I think, on purpose.
Yeah.
But some of the wildest, sophisticated kind of approaches, at least the creative thinking to get into an environment, A lot of times, like this article, you don't necessarily know why they're getting in, right? But you know, if you follow some of the actor groups that are backed by PRC, like, you understand that it's almost always espionage and foothold. So they can get in low and slow like this, blend in, and then they're there. They're just waiting to do a thing when it's time to do a thing. And it's just a fun, it's a fun read when you educate yourself on these. And it's also, I think, really good for security practitioners to understand like the nation state approach to stuff. But yeah. All right, Scott, what's last this week?
So the last one, just kind of another interesting kind of covert used to target, actually an interesting target set. So it's a hack read article that kind of covers Morphosex malware research. And it's titled PyStore Rat, a Multipurpose Evasive Threat. Well, sorry, that wasn't titled. That was the header of something else. The real title is The New PyStore Rat Malware Targets OSINT Researchers Through GitHub. Basically, what's interesting about this is they're noticing that there were GitHub repos that were being spun up, and it was AI kind of generated code that would work enough and be convincing enough for IT administration, cybersecurity folk, open source intelligence folk to be interested in finding these repos. It helped the repos grow in popularity. And then when they downloaded, essentially kind of had like a Python type of execution that would then pull down a HTA file, which would be executed by MSHTA. And that basically would set the base for everything as far as the malware. And, you know, from it was able to then, you can run JavaScript, more Python code, PowerShell. It can spread via mounted devices. It created persistence via scheduled task. So all the common things you kind of see there. And, you know, it's just really interesting. Just kind of another way to basically get easy hooks in. And then, you know, people talk about AI being like, oh, we got to worry about AI and attacks. And still, this is a great example that it's not the AI tools that are actually attacking. They're just enabling attackers to make things work very easily, potentially blend in very easily. And that's kind of how I predict a lot of that's going to be for quite some time. So, you know, that was one of the key things there. Let's see what else they typically do here. One of the things I thought was interesting from the spreading piece, when they would want to propagate with removable media, they would basically infect a USB drive by replacing files with malicious .lnks, right? So essentially kind of what we've seen from, you know, some phishing and other things where you have an LNK with the target file is basically maybe a PowerShell script that can then download an executed payload. Same thing, but what's interesting here is they're basically replacing stuff that you know already exists on the USB that you might actually use or open with this to basically spread that infection to other things. And it seems to be driven from a Russian-based thing. So they talked about some of the language they saw for like system, for instance, in the malware. And, you know, there was the Russian word for system. So there's some attribution from that perspective, which is interesting based on just knowing what's going on in Russia and in the fact they're going after OSINT and admin type professionals in general. And in the ways where, especially if there's USBs, they're being leveraged. Like I can sit there and speculate, do the conspiracy theory of why they have some of these hooks, the way they have these hooks and why they're targeting what they're targeting. But you know, just a really interesting, way to target certain sets of individuals. GitHub's a great popular place. The types of tools they were basically creating these repos for, clearly were popular amongst people that kind of surf and look for things in GitHub, because the popularity for some of these really shot up, which, you know, added kind of a trust aspect that wasn't legitimate, because you would see a lot of people promoting it essentially. But it basically was a rat in the back end. So gave access, was able to basically steal things, and maintain that kind of persistence. So yeah, just kind of another call out of just another interesting way where these infections are kind of coming in and kind of who they're targeting from that aspect. That that was pretty interesting. But once again, kind of a simple way to look at that initial execution is a big key piece. What's spawning MSHTA in your environment is a huge indicator. And then not only that, but what does it spawn? That goes to those what do I call them? Exploit chains, but it's not exploit. Does execution change? Those are pretty much the key indicators for a lot of stuff we talked about paying attention to. So, yeah, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, good point. Now, the adaptability part was interesting to me. From the first and foremost, so you talked about the USB piece, but like its ability apparently to like look for specific security software. You know, it talked about identifying CrowdStrike Falcon or Cyreason to kind of hide from them to reduce its visibility. That one always stands out to me because I like when I see that kind of thought process. The other part too is, you know, I guess lead to a conversational question. We've talked about the infection vector from GitHub before, and it's not that GitHub is inherently bad at all, like obviously, but it's curious when you're, because you can, as an attacker, if I'm using GitHub as a leverage point, I'm generally targeting people that are going to execute code or pull code yeah. down, because that's the nature of the platform, right? So it makes sense as an attacker to target that area. But when you are just the user or even the defender, when you go to GitHub and you're looking at potentially leveraging a Newell tool set, what are the checks that you would do generally? Because it seems to me like the popularity rating, because we've talked in the past about how people have, or how they've leveraged, like, you know, bot systems to build this up, right? Like they'll add 1,000 users and it starts gaining popularity, starts moving up in it's trending, whatever. And then you kind of see that it's trending, you see all these users, so it might make you think, okay, cool, this is safe to try, or go for this, or this is interesting to me, so I'm gonna pull it down. But I'm just curious, like, when you're a user, like I'm almost giving you like a phishing test, because I don't know the true answer.
Yeah.
What would somebody look for when they're going to GitHub to pull something down to kind of defend themselves against gotchas? Like, what would be things that you think, Scott, that they could check for?
So this is something I'm surprised people don't talk about and probably don't put in practice for, I don't know, maybe a myriad of reasons. But, you know, especially if I'm looking, like when I go to GitHub and there's some interesting thing there, I kind of look at the notes. I kind of sometimes will like briefly look at the code to see if it looks like the person who even coded something is a coder or a developer. You can tell based on how people code, like what their experience level is. When you kind of get used to seeing code in general. But yeah, no one has the time to dig through everything, understand everything. But, you know, we have this great tool now that there's no reason why you can't just say, hey, is there anything questionable in this, and throwing the raw code, because you should have the open source code in ChatGPT. If it's like, oh, this is so obfuscated, I have no idea. Well, this having obfuscation would be questionable. Or it could highlight, hey, there's some functions that do this type of behavior. If this isn't what you're looking for, you know, be cautious. Or yeah, this is supposed to pull something down and execute it. Maybe you should look at what this pulls down first before you run this, you know, type of thing. Kind of give you a passing score on some stuff, right? So I don't know why that's not just a capability built in, not only to like, is this safe or not, but can it help explain what it is you're running, you know, really well, to understand maybe how to run it better, or things you may not even think about, or maybe ways it might break, it might just highlight, right? So I don't know if developers are doing that with a lot of their, I mean, some libraries are huge, right? So it's not as feasible. GitHub is probably an easier place to do it. Now, if you talk about like NPM packages and things where, you know, you can have, you might hit the contextual token limit and some of these chat tools, AI tools, LLMs. But I still think that's a measure that at least at a casual level should be taken, right? Because it doesn't hurt and it doesn't really eat up that much more time, and potentially could even save you a lot of time As long as you're not doing it to like try to say rewrite this code, right? That's not going to be as efficient as just saying, what are some things that would stand out as, does this fetch anything? Does this execute anything outside of just me running it? Is this kind of self-contained? Does this have any dependencies? Like those type of common things that you may have seen patterns for how malware has gotten into extensions or how malware has gotten into whatever. I think just would be a legitimate use for, you know, practitioners moving forward.
Yeah, I like that answer. Me, I'm over here. I'm like, my initial thoughts were like, well, the usage of it and how many users are leveraging it, things like that would give me a comfortability. But as I've learned over the recent couple of months, that's probably not a good approach, at least for like a soft check, right? It's obviously not an absolute. If me, if I had it my way, if I'm pulling something from GitHub, I want to put it in a container somewhere. I want to put it in a VM in a closed area where I can at least run and see. But most people aren't going to do that, right? The other thing that I used to check for is like the variance of updates, right? The time stamps on some of the updates, like how long has it been out there? Like, is it giving that kind of tried and true stability? You know what I mean? But even that is not necessarily a direct path, but those are checks that I would do, but I like yours better.
Yeah. And you know, it just comes down to being a security professional. Like sometimes you just want someone to ask, right? We're always scared to ask, or the ask might be a huge lift for other people. So it's like, you know, you ask the wrong question. Someone's like, well, this should be your job. Why am I doing your job for you? But that's kind of how I treat sometimes ChatGPT is like, hey, I just need that sounding board. Like, I just want to ask. I don't really care what the answer is. Like, I'll interpret that after the fact. It's not going to like dictate what I do, but I just need to like have that thought out loud and have something say and reflect back. Did that thought even make sense to even ask, think about? Is there things I'm not thinking about? You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's plenty of studies out there that talk about, you know, our brains process information as we deliver them at the same time. So talking about it, like having the conversation, getting a response back to add, fill in the holes of your thinking. And it just sparks the whole right approach. So, yeah, I used like ChatGPT for that. Primarily just to help me with a sounding board, right? Not for answers, but help me think about what I'm not thinking about to solve this problem.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, I think that kind of brings us to a close. Nothing really major, to give me one to look forward to in the near couple of weeks with the holidays coming. But definitely I want to thank everyone for joining us, this week for the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, it closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of December 15th, 2025.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.